Welcome to the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. I'm Uncle Dennis here at Free Radio Santa Cruz on Thursday, March 23rd. I'd like to ask you to have a pencil and paper handy to write down names, addresses, telephone numbers, web pages, whatever it takes for you to take action. Let's start off with announcements. Remembering David Kay in this story by Eric Wesselman from Friends of the River. This winter we lost a legendary river hero in David Kay. Several years before David would help found Friends of the River in 1973, he came out west and fell in love with rivers. He found a home at the American River Touring Association and became a skilled boatman and river guide. He quickly rose through the ranks and helped ARTA become a special outfitter by offering river trips that were much more than a Disneyland experience. They became special adventures into nature that connected people to rivers, the kind of experiences that stay with a person and change lives. David introduced and shared rivers with people and developed a unique ability to poetically and powerfully communicate their magic. It wasn't before long that David met Jerry Merrill and many others who were building a movement for rivers in California. These friendships and collaborations helped David leverage his gift for communicating to inspire activism on behalf of rivers. In 1973, the campaign to save the Stanislaus River from the new Melones Dam was growing into a statewide effort. That fall, David and Jerry met with Rob Callahan and David Oakey, two legendary rough-and-tumble organizers, to start organizing a statewide initiative to save the river. Of course, they needed an organization to run it, and Friends of the River was born. After riding the campaign roller coaster that helped end the era of big dam building and establish Friends of the River as a statewide river protection organization, David returned to Ohio, where he lived with friends and family and pursued his other passion, gardening. While he was far from California for much of the rest of his life, those around him knew that the magic of rivers always remained in his heart. While it takes a team and community to build a movement, it is still the sum of individuals who step forward to be a part of it. David was an indispensable part. He was one of those individuals who served as a guide for the movement and a spark that put many on a path to a lifetime of advocacy and rivers. Our heart goes out to his family and all who knew him. And you can find out more information at www.for.org. And Tyler Lang has been released from a halfway house, and he's done with probation. In this story from Support Kevin and Tyler, as found on the Earth First Newswire. A year ago, Tyler Lang was sentenced to 3 months' time served, 6 months' home imprisonment, 6 months in a halfway house, and a year of supervised release, along with restitution. Today, he was released from a halfway house, and his term of supervised release ended. Tyler was sentenced under the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act for freeing 2,000 mink from a fur farm and spray painting Liberation is Love on the side of a barn with his co-defendant Kevin Johnson. The fur farm closed down as a result of their actions, saving generations of animals from being tortured and killed there. Tyler has been eagerly awaiting this day and is excited to keep moving on with his life. He is grateful for all the support that people have shown him and Kevin since their arrest. So thank you to everyone who wrote to him, made a donation, spread awareness about their case, and turned the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act indictment into a time of showing solidarity. Celebrate this day with Tyler and also take time to support people who are still imprisoned and to work for animals who are still in cages. And you can find out more information about this and other stories at the Earth First Newswire. That's www.earthfirstjournal/newswire. And Sea Shepherd has discovered a dead vaquita porpoise floating in the Gulf of California. Sea Shepherd found the body of a dead vaquita porpoise floating in the Gulf of California on Sunday, March 19, 2017. The nonprofit Marine Conservation Society has been in the Upper Gulf since last fall as part of Operation Milagro 3 to save the vaquita and the endangered Tatoeba bass. Sea Shepherd's anti-poaching ships, the motor vessel Farley Mowat and motor yacht San Simon, are currently patrolling the area. At 2:47 p.m. on Sunday, the Farley Mowat crew came across a dead vaquita known as the world's smallest porpoise and notified the Mexican authorities to retrieve it. The carcass is currently being held in San Felipe, Baja California, frozen, awaiting an examination to determine its cause of death. With a near extinction vaquita porpoise now numbering less than 30, the devastating sight comes exactly 1 week after a sea shepherd found a dead newborn vaquita on the beach just 33 kilometers south of San Felipe. Witnessing one of the few remaining vaquita in the entire world dead and floating in front of our ship was devastating to my crew, said Farley Mowat Captain Luisa Albera. We are continuing to stay focused on retrieving all the nets that are trapping the vaquita to death. Over the weekend, the Farley Mowat and San Simeon recovered 11 illegal totoba nets. These nets are the most common cause of death for vaquita as it entangles the porpoise, causing it to drown. These nets are set up by illegal fishermen to trap the totoba and export its swim bladder for sale on the black markets in Hong Kong and China, where it is prized for unsubstantiated medical properties and can fetch more than $20,000 per kilogram, or about $10,000 per pound. Due to this high street value, the totoba bladder is frequently referred to as aquatic cocaine and is the only reason this fish is being killed. The illicit trafficking of totoba swim bladders in the Gulf of California is at an all-time high. If things continue at this rate, there is little hope for the vaquita's survival, said Operation Milagro 3 campaign leader in San Simon, Captain Una Leol. It is depressing to witness the extinction of a species due to human greed. Despite the devastating deaths seen in the past week, Sea Shepherd's relentless work in the Gulf continues to save many of the marine mammals' lives, and we will continue to protect marine mammals here, including the vaquita. And hunt saboteurs in Britain are assaulted by the notorious Yorkshire Hunt from Hunt Saboteurs Association, as found on the Earth First Newswire. Hunt saboteurs were assaulted by members of the Middleton Hunt after their meet at Unkleby, North Yorkshire, on Saturday the 18th of March. Riders from the hunt stole a video camera and two body cams, hit the sabs in the heads with their whips, and attempted to ride them down and jumped off their horses to continue the attacks. One female saboteur had cracked ribs after being crushed between two horses. Other sabs suffered serious head injuries and broken fingers. Multiple ambulances had to be called to the scene, and several of the injured were encouraged to attend hospital. The attack was filmed, attackers have been identified, and this information has been passed to the police, who have an ongoing investigation. The footage can't currently be released due to that investigation. Lee Moon, spokesman for the Hunt Saboteurs Association, stated, "In 2015, an undercover investigation implicated the Middleton Hunt in the rearing of captive foxes to be hunted illegally. In January this year, huntsman Charles Carter was filmed making sexually inappropriate comments to a member of the public. He subsequently had to resign as a Tory councillor. The Hunt have now added violent assault and theft to their list of crimes and are fast becoming one of the most notorious in the country. We repeatedly see hunters using their horses as weapons and have been shown in recent years this can result in serious injuries. We are hopeful that the large number of police who attended the scene yesterday are indicative of how seriously they are taking this situation, and we look forward to a swift and positive investigation." Lord Middleton of Birdsall was joint master of the hunt until 2013 and was at their and has their kennels on his Birdsall estate. It is alleged that he no longer allows the hunt on his land due to the recent controversies. It will be interesting to see how he reacts to having his name associated with robbery and violent assault. And from the Buffalo Field Campaign, we read their Buffalo Field Campaign's update for this week. Yellowstone's buffalo trap is emptying rapidly, with little sign that rangers intend to capture more buffalo. The outer pens are empty, and the parts of the trap where buffalo were recently confined now hold the horses of Yellowstone's wranglers. There are still approximately 30 buffalo in this small enclosure, but no stock trailers have arrived to haul them to the slaughterhouse. We do not know what the Park Service has planned for them. We haven't seen any hunters lately, and there are very few buffalo on the landscape. With most of the surviving buffalo in the Gardner Basin beginning their migration south to their spring calving grounds, we are hopeful that the killing season is coming to a close. 1,300 buffalo have been killed this winter, sent to slaughter by the National Park Service or shot by hunters. That's 1,300 individual buffalo, members of America's only continuously wild population, gone forever and never to walk the earth again. This winter's slaughter comes second only to the year 2008, when government agencies slaughtered more than 1,600 wild buffalo. Such killings are the result of Montana's intolerance for wild buffalo forced upon the federal government through its interagency bison management plan. People often ask, how do you do it? How do you bear witness to such horrible actions against the buffalo? Our answer is, because we need to. Our constant presence holds the agencies accountable, draws global attention to the crimes against wild buffalo, and has resulted in many victories. Without our constant presence, the atrocious actions against the buffalo would go largely unnoticed. The little information getting out would be sugar-coated in government spin, and the buffalo would be treated far worse than they are now. Without Buffalo Field Campaign in the field, no one would know the truth. This is why we are here bearing witness, standing with the buffalo on their chosen ground, living this reality with them and exposing the truth. When enough people do become aware of what the federal and Montana governments are doing to our last wild buffalo, when they raise their voices to demand that it stop, only then will the buffalo be free. Until that day, the Buffalo Field Campaign will be here doing everything in our power. And I encourage you to visit the Buffalo Field Campaign's website, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And do remember that the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And recent urban coyote death has been linked to restricted rodenticides. The carcass of a young and otherwise healthy coyote found in a San Francisco park has tested positive for four different kinds of rat poison, all of which are illegal for non-professional use in California. The body of the female coyote was found in Douglas Park in February. Lab test results recently received by WildCare proved that the coyote's death was caused by the consumption of rats that had in turn been poisoned by rodenticides. Most urban coyote deaths are caused by cars, but radiographs, that is x-rays, and a postmortem exam at WildCare showed that this coyote had no external injuries. If an animal the size of a coyote can ingest enough poisoned rats to kill her, there is no arguing about the prevalence of rodenticides in our environment and the extreme danger of using these poisons, said Kelly Karkmersik, director of advocacy at WildCare. Regulations enacted in 2014 restrict the usage of most toxic anticoagulant rodenticides to only licensed pest control operators. Homeowners and residents facing pest problems should properly dispose of any previously purchased pesticides containing the active ingredients Brodafacum, bromodialone, difethylone, or difenacum. A list of statewide facilities that are authorized to dispose of household hazardous waste can be found at the website. In addition to state regulations, the City of San Francisco maintains a strong anti-rodenticide stance. City and county entities are required to use less toxic alternatives to manage rodents and only use poison as a last result. Rodenticides are not used in city parks, including Glen Canyon, Douglas, and Christopher Parks in San Francisco. The coyote's necropsy report showed the cause of death to be massive internal bleeding due to rat poisoning. Four different types of rat poisons were detected in her liver. Since each brand of commercially available rat poison only carries one of the available rodenticides compounds, a coyote must have eaten rats poisoned from at least four different sources. It is impossible to determine the exact sources of those poisons. This otherwise healthy coyote died as a result of either residents or local businesses hiring pest control operators or the illegal use of rodenticides by consumers. These poisons are everywhere, and ironically, they are killing the very animal nature provides to control rodent populations, Karkmersik said. WildCare has been actively testing rodent predators since 2006. Over the last 11 years, 76% of predatory animals tested have been found to carry one or more rat poisons in their blood. And if you want more information, go to www.wildlife.ca.gov/living-with-wildlife/rodenticides or www.wildcarebayarea.org/rodenticide. And from the Environmental Protection Information Center, we have this story. Timber sale monitors find trees marked in riparian reserves, as written by Amber Shelton of the Environmental Protection Information Staff. EPIC staff and volunteers have been getting out into the field and ground-truthing timber sales to verify compliance with Forest Service decisions and environmental policies. The JESS project, a timber sale in the North Fork of the Salmon River watershed proposed by the Klamath National Forest, would treat about 1,960 acres, including ridgetop, roadside, silvicultural, and meadow treatments. Environmental Protection Information Center is engaged throughout the environmental review process by attending field trips, doing field reviews, submitting substantive comments, participating in the multi-party monitoring group, filing an objection to the project, and getting boots on the ground to verify whether the project is properly implemented. While monitoring the JESS project, EPIC found that many fire-resistant, mature, and old-growth trees on north-facing slopes, as well as trees located in riparian reserves that were marked to be logged. Using mobile mapping software, EPIC staff was able to take GPS-referenced photos of the project area and directly plot them on the Forest Service project map to illustrate how silviculture prescriptions described in the environmental impact statement displayed on the map of the proposed action were not reflective of the marked trees on the ground. According to page 21 of the JESS project final environmental impact statement, there are 2,265 acres of hydrologic riparian reserves in the project area, and there are no treatments proposed on those acres. However, within a few riparian reserves that were monitored by EPIC, this was not the case. Instead, large groups of mature trees were marked for harvest in the middle of riparian reserves that were supposed to be protected and off-limits to logging. The wild and scenic North Fork Salmon River is an important watershed for one of the last remaining wild spring Chinook salmon runs and contains critical habitat for rare and threatened species. Logging in riparian reserves causes salmon choking sediment to flow into creeks throughout the watershed, which have been cumulatively hit over the years by wildfire, firefighting, and post-fire logging. EPIC staff was able to document those areas and report findings to the Klamath National Forest and North Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board. Some of these areas have been corrected and remarked. However, there are other areas that need to be looked at prior to the project going out for bid. EPIC will be helping to ensure that the rest of the waterways are adequately protected. If you want more information about this plan or the Environmental Protection Information Center, go to their webpage, www.wildcalifornia.org. And from Field and Stream, we read that the plan to save Oregon's Elliott State Forest may not be enough, in a story written by Chris Milgate of Field and Stream. This week, Oregon lawmakers held a full hearing for a bill that would prevent the sale of the prized 82,500-acre Elliott State Forest. The potential sale of the state-owned land stemming from declining timber revenues has become a hotly contested one in recent months, with state officials divided on the issue and sportsmen and conservation groups and the general and public weighing in. Oregon Senate Bill 847 would give the state ability to remove the forest or any unprofitable state land from the public school trust in which it is currently held, and which stipulates that it must generate revenue to a different state agency or institution that could, in theory, better manage the property and prevent its sale. Removing the forest from the public school trust would keep the area open to the public, whereas selling it would close it off to hunting, fishing, and other recreation. The Register Guard knows that the bill is essentially a plan for the state to buy the forest from itself at a cost of roughly $100 million in addition to continued timber revenue from the tract. The plan is backed by Governor Kate Brown, one of the Oregon State Land Board's three members, who will ultimately decide the fate of the forest. As the Register Guard reports, the board's other two members were unpersuaded by the plan when first presented with it, which doesn't bode well for Brown's efforts or for the forest's future. Not only will Brown need to convince at least one of the other board members to side with her, but the state legislature will also have to authorize at least $100 million in bonds to prevent the sale, both of which will no doubt prove challenging. As Field and Stream reported in February, revenue generated by logging in the forest is down and has been for years, resulting from lawsuits that curb timber production, compounded by high management costs. Since the land wasn't generating enough revenue, the state was put in a position of needing to sell it as required by law. Only one offer for the property came in, a joint purchase worth $221 million from Lone Rock Timber Management and the Cow Creek Band of Umpqua Indians. The Oregonian reports that all three members of the land board received campaign contributions totaling $89,000 from the parties looking to buy the forest. And a uranium mine near the Grand Canyon has been filling with contaminated water. Mine operator Energy Fuels violates their plan of operations to clear out excess water, and drilling continues despite expired environmental impacts. By the story by Hall No, as found on the Earth First Newswire. The controversial Canyon mine, located just 6 miles from Grand Canyon South Rim, is filling with surplus water after a wet winter. In an effort to dispose of water at the bottom of the mine shaft, mine owner Energy Fuels Resources USA Incorporated is trucking the contaminated water to the White Mesa Mill uranium processing facility near Blanding, Utah, and spraying it into the air and on the adjacent Kaibab National Forest in an attempt to evaporate it. The plan of operations requires that all excess water be retained on site in holding ponds and be treated there. Simultaneously, Energy Fuels has allowed state environmental permits intended to help protect groundwater to expire. Communities on the Navajo Nation along the haul route from Canyon Mine to White Mesa Mill were not formally notified of the hazardous materials being transported. The route traverses 300 miles, with approximately 180 miles going through Navajo Nation and the Ute Mountain Ute community south of the mill. The Navajo Nation has a law that restricts transport of radioactive materials, including uranium ore, over, under, or across Navajo Indian country. However, Navajo does not have jurisdiction over the state roads of the haul route. Those trucks have been marked non-potable water, and at least one truck observed had a placard misidentifying the contents as petroleum products. Indigenous peoples are not just concerned about the transport, but also about Red Butte, a designated tribal cultural property and sacred site near the mine, as well as risks to precious water resources, the possibility of accidents, lack of emergency response capabilities, and the impacts to human health, plants, and wildlife. As the Navajo Nation, we have dealt with uranium since the Cold War and are still dealing with mines left behind by irresponsible people. The last thing we need is for another mine transferring it through our communities. No haul, said Milton So, Cameron Chapter President. The U.S. Forest Service did not require Energy Fuels to update its 1986 plan of operations to reflect new information or technology when it began drilling after nearly 30 years on standby, where the mine sat and was non-operational. Now, before the mine has even removed any uranium ore, they seem to be out of compliance with their plan. Furthermore, Energy Fuels allowed its permits for the on-site storage of physical material that has been removed from the mine shaft to expire in August of 2016. The Arizona Department of Environmental Quality has not received any paperwork for the company for the renewal of those permits. And you can get information about this by going to Intercontinental Cry. That's www.intercontinentalcry.org. And moving to environmental news from the Center for Biological Diversity. And the Senate has approved slaughter in Alaska wildlife refuges. Senate Republicans this week passed a resolution to strip federal safeguards from wolves, bears, and other predators in national wildlife refuges in Alaska, allowing the unsportsmanlike killing of wolves and their pups in their dens and the gunning down of bears and their cubs at bait stations. Joint Resolution 69, passed on Tuesday, repealed protections put in place by the Obama administration in 2016. This isn't hunting, it's slaughter, said Brett Hardy with the Center for Biological Diversity. Killing wolves and bears in this cruel fashion is outrageous, especially in a national wildlife refuge. Repealing protections also undermines predators' critical ecosystem roles. The Center for Biological Diversity will continue its fight to defend these important animals. and a bat-killing epidemic has spread to Nebraska, a highly contagious fungal disease that killed millions of bats in North America, was confirmed in Nebraska last week, the 30th state to be affected. So far, 7 U.S. bat species have been hit by the illness called the white nose syndrome. The spread of this disease to places like Nebraska and as far west as Washington should ring alarm bells across the United States, said the Center for Biological Diversity's Molly Madison. Land managers from the West need to work now to stop it from spreading further before it's too late. And Mono Lake is likely to rise in the next year. Last week, the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power released its preliminary runoff forecast based on the record-breaking March 1st snow surveys. And that reveals that there is 195% of the average runoff for the April 2017 through March 31st, 2018 runoff year. This runoff volume projection is very similar to that experienced in 1983, the wettest runoff year on record. Due to warm storms in January and February, the lower elevation snowpack below about 9,000 feet above sea level is much lower than in 1983. So the Mono Lake Committee are assuming that the record runoff is a high-end scenario. That forecast also assumes median precipitation over the next year. And you can get more information by going to www.monolake.org. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is produced every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock here at Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, and www.freakradio.org. You can also hear a rebroadcast of this show tomorrow, Friday afternoon at 3 p.m. Or if North Adams, Massachusetts, you can tune to WMNB 107.1, Fridays at 5:30. KRFP 90.3 FM in Moscow, Idaho, Wednesdays at 3 p.m. In Dade City, Florida, WLSL 92.7, Sundays at noon. Or you could tune in to the Grateful Dread Public Radio on the Internet, gdprnashville.org. That's gdprnashville.org, Sundays at 2 a.m. Here in California, you can listen to KGIG in Modesto, California on the frequency of 104.9 or Berkeley Liberation Radio at 104.1. Both of those stations rebroadcast the Earth First Update but don't have the time on their schedule. You can always go to radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net, where you can listen online or download this show anytime you want to. And please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update every week. It is free to download and air. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening to the Earth First Update, which is a production of Earth First Radio and produced at Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening, and do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.